Hello everyone, welcome back to Deep Psychology. I am Ross, and in this episode we're going to talk about the developmental stages of meditation. So the overall theme of this episode is that meditation isn't just a practice measured in hours. It's not just an activity, it's not just a tool. It's actually a kind of journey, shall we say, that tends to unfold in developmental stages. So there is a sort of vertical development or dimension to meditation that often gets overlooked and often isn't made very explicit. So basically in this episode, we're going to be talking about the three stages of meditation, and this is going to be linked to the bigger theme of the month, which is just going to be meditation and spirituality in general, and talking about the big picture of meditation and spirituality. This development, this developmental stages of meditation isn't about how calm you feel. It's not about how pleasant your meditation is. It's not about how long you can sit for. Of course, if you meditate for many years, you're going to probably be able to sit for longer and longer. But these stages are not about that. Okay, so I'm not just going to be measuring it according to these metrics that you might think indicate a person's depth of practice. What I'm really measuring here is the structure of identity. How does meditation affect your identity, your nervous system, and your relationship to spiritual awakening? This is really what determines the stages and this vertical movement. Years practice doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be at the third stage or the second stage, because most people simply remain at the early stage, which, you know, that's fine, but ultimately, you know, if we're talking about depth and we're talking about really understanding ourselves, then we have to realize that there are these stages and that the later ones do afford a deeper understanding of one's true identity. So let's talk about the early stage now that we've cleared up those things. You'll know the early stage if you are either a meditator yourself or you've met other meditators, or both, of course. And really, because most, the sort of general view of society of meditation is an early stage meditation, very, very early stage. And so when I'm describing this, it will seem very familiar to you. Almost so familiar, you might question, well, how is this a stage, Ross? Because this seems like what meditation is. Well, this is what I'm talking about. Meditation retunes your relationship to identity, to spiritual awakening, and to really your experience of life. And so, of course, if we look at the normal, it's going to come from the early stage simply because it's based on sort of the average person's perception. So the core orientation at the early stage is that meditation is something that you do. It's an activity. It's something that requires effort. It's something that requires special time, a certain place, a certain set of conditions. Awakening, if it's considered at all, because quite honestly, a lot of meditators never consider this or even come across the concept of spiritual awakening. But if you do, at the early stage, you will consider awakening to be a future event that will come about through hard work and perseverance, and it seems distant, it seems sort of grand, it seems almost untouchable, unfathomable, it seems kind of mythic, it has like a mythic glow, spiritual awakening. there is a kind of dualistic structure. There is the concept of me, my practice, and my progress. So it's like the self is moving somewhere through a certain vehicle. Some of the features of this stage is that insight is mostly conceptual. So for example, in Buddhism, they have the concepts of impermanence and emptiness. Now, at the early stage, you will just tend to see these things as concepts. Oh, well, the concept of impermanence says that everything is always changing and we cannot build a house on the shifting sand of reality because it's always shifting and changing. And this will tend to be an abstract thing. You know, it'll tend to be related to life circumstances or politics or the economy. It'll frame how you interpret these things, but it doesn't necessarily come down to the level of experience. The same thing with emptiness. You might look out there and see, well, you might see the sort of emptiness behind society, behind culture, behind the world around you, in that appearances are just appearances and they arise in consciousness. But this, again, maybe doesn't filter all the way down to your direct experience. There's constant evaluation of meditation, and this is really one of the things that most people fall into for a very long time, and it's what really all of sort of the average view of society is built on. This it's basically built on the idea that you can have good meditation where you feel calm and you feel sort of focused and you feel like insights are coming, and then you can have bad meditation on the other hand. You can have meditation where you feel restless and you feel like it lasts forever, and you feel that you're lost in thought, and you feel that you're thinking about what happened 20 years ago. So there's good and there's bad meditation, and the two are very clearly distinguished, and they actually create, you know, this is like a battle. The battle becomes, how much good meditation can I have? Thoughts are still believed, so there's not really a clear separation between thought and awareness yet, and thus the mind continues to form a cage around you because you are not realizing that the mind is just appearances. It's not reality. It's not necessarily truthful. It's just appearances. Thoughts are just what they are. This is yet to come. And so you still fundamentally are even relating to meditation and spirituality from the level of your mind and from your thoughts and from concepts. Emotions are sticky at this stage. So meditation is often used to manage discomfort, to make you feel better, to soothe, to get rid of anxiety, to relax your nervous system and so on. There's not the clear, pure insight of emotions as just empty arisings in the body that don't need to be clinged to. They don't need to be rejected either. They can just be seen through like ripples on a lake that have no substance to them whatsoever. A spiritual identity forms, so the person will start to create this identity around being a meditator, and they might start altering their behavior in a certain way. They may begin to act calm when they don't feel calm. They may pretend to feel good all the time when that isn't true. They may wear certain clothes that identify them as a meditator. They may speak differently in a deliberate way because they're a meditator. So you see, there's an identity of I am a meditator, and then that identity is reinforced through behavior and through choices that will project to other people that you are a meditator. And it seems from this point of view that this when you're at the early stage, you sort of have this idea that all I need to do is become more of that. You know, I just need to wear over time, I'll just be a better meditator. I'll have better meditation sessions, and I'll start wearing more, what's the word? Sort of mystical clothing, and I'll have a name, and people will be able to tell right away that I'm a meditator. There is comparison with other practitioners. There is subtle performance, as I've mentioned, which basically means that you are trying to uphold the identity of being a meditator, and you're comparing your own identity as a meditator with that of others, and sort of trying to perfect the paraphernalia of it. And if you're a teacher from the early stage, you will tend to believe that you are an authority on meditation and that other people really need to learn it and that they're missing something. So that is the early stage. So clearly there are strengths here. You know, if you approach meditation in this way, clearly you're going to be disciplined about it, you're committed to it, and you have a certain reverence for it. You know, you respect perhaps the process of awakening, you respect the power of meditation. So this is good, and it builds a stability, and ultimately it builds an identity through which you'll eventually undo that identity, without which you may never get to the stage where you undo it. So it's good in that sense, and clearly because many people remain here, there must be something to it. I guess the something to it that I would say is that it helps you build an identity as a meditator. And for some people, that's what they need. And they won't go any further than that. However, clearly, when you move beyond this stage, you clearly realize that it's very limited, and it is a sort of transitional stage, and that it has a lot of limitations to it. I've not done research myself. However, I would suspect that most people remain in the early stage. I'm talking 80% plus, or even 90% of all meditation practitioners. For so many reasons, but I think fundamentally the tricky part here is that having an identity as a meditator and telling people you're a meditator and being able to teach people about it and being able to kind of advertise it is very tempting, and it's very seducing. And this is what we do with most other things. You know, if you're learning an instrument, the most common thing to do when you learn an instrument is to tell everyone about it, to broadcast it, and then to kind of, you know, if a friend is learning, then you'll give them tips and advice, and you'll sort of butt in a little bit perhaps. This is so tempting, you know, it's a very common human trait. And this is actually the barrier, one of the very big barriers to moving on with your insight and your relationship to perception and to awakening. And frankly, it's just the status quo in terms of if you go to a lot of spiritual centers, if you go to a lot of like yoga classes, if you go to even a lot of meditation classes, even the instructor who's been teaching maybe for 10 years, or they've been practicing for more than that, 20 years, I don't know. They've been practicing for a long time, teaching for a long time. It's not that they're fundamentally perhaps operating from the early stage. I can't know that for sure, but they cater to early stage because that's what pays for the class, that's what makes them some money, that's what gets people in, because experienced meditators are very rare. Why am I saying this? Because when you're a meditator and that's the material you're exposed to, it's very difficult to realize that there's more to it than this. So I bet you're dying to know what is the next stage. So this is mid-stage, I'm going to call it. My estimate is that about 5 to 10% of meditators reach mid-stage, which is quite a damning statistic, really. These aren't hard facts. These are kind of estimates. But you can decide, you know, look around you and see, you know, and think to your own experience and see, you know, what do you think? The core shift at the mid stage is that thoughts lose their authority over you. They are seen as appearances, not truths. And that's what I alluded to just a few minutes ago. So the mid stage, your identity is starting to dissolve, basically, because as soon as your thoughts lose authority, that's another way of saying that the main mechanism by which your sense of identity, your sense of self, your sense of being who you are, not in a psychological way, but in a moment-to-moment sense, is thoughts. And that is starting to dissolve and they're starting to lose their solidity. And so your identity is going to start dissolving, absolutely. This little shift, well, it's not a little shift at all, but this one shift right here explains a lot of what happens at the mid stage. Some changes you will notice is that your emotions arise, but they resolve faster. They don't have this clinging sense to them. You don't feel the need to run away from them. That's why they resolve, because when there's no resistance behind them, they don't crystallize and solidify in your experience. And so they can just dissolve, like all experience does, because it's essentially impermanent. That's getting ahead of ourselves, though. And this, I think, is because when you've meditated for long enough, you've basically practiced sitting with yourself, with your body, your mind, for so long that you learn to stop resisting, you learn to stop putting barriers up, you learn to stop fighting with what's happening in your mind and body. And so emotions are just part of that. This is a natural extension of your meditation skills. Now, obviously, it depends on the type of meditation you're doing, but, you know, as a general thing, you're always just sitting with your mind and body. And any good meditation technique will teach you to stop resisting what you're experiencing. There's less storytelling and less evaluation. What I mean by this is that you don't build like a huge story around your meditation so much. It's more just something you do. It's not part of this narrative that you're going to like grow into some sage or you're going to become awakened one day. That's still there, but not so much. You're not evaluating the meditation. You're not evaluating so much your mind and body all the time. You're not trying to feel good all the time. You're not trying to use meditation as a means to an end. You're more just doing it for the sake of doing it. Meditation bleeds into daily life. So no longer is it this separate activity that you do for 15, 20, 30 minutes or however long. It's not that it's fully integrated, but it's there. It's like you can call on it. You can bring up your meditation skills. You can notice when you're getting lost in thought. You notice when your emotions are carrying you away. You notice when you're, say, in a social situation and instead of enjoying it, you're lost in your mind and all your own inner stuff. And you can just anchor yourself in your senses more and be in the present. These things, so it's not like a complete rewiring of your daily life, but, you know, it's starting to really influence it. And you're going to really start noticing how important meditation is at this point. And it's going to be like quite shocking, actually, to see the contrast. There's a greater tolerance for discomfort. Now, this is just, if you look at the scientific studies on meditation, this is one of the main things they've picked up on through people who've done sort of 1,000+ hours of meditation, is that their relationship to pain, physical pain and emotional discomfort really changes on quite a fundamental level. And you will notice this. And again, it's really because you're learning not to resist your experience. And you'll learn that a lot of the time that the pain that we feel is not really the raw sensation of pain. It's actually our own psychological interpretation of the pain and how we add on to it and how we multiply it through by doing that. And so this goes hand in hand with the ability to tolerate emotions as well. The shift in identity at the mid stage is that the self becomes partially transparent. So you can start to see how your body and your mental images and your thoughts come together to create the sense that you are who you are. And when you start to notice that, you start to realize that the self is not really a thing. It's a pattern that appears in consciousness. Now, this isn't fully present and it's not fully automatic yet, but it's starting, we're getting there. You're starting to realize that all these different components of the self are really rather, they have no real substance to them. And therefore yourself has no real substance to it. The mid stage can be rather destabilizing because ultimately if we zoom out, you're going from just ordinary perception, ordinary identification with the self, ordinary subject-object consciousness to awakened consciousness, shall we say. And in that process, of course, there's a lot of positive symptoms, shall we say, but there's negative symptoms. It's like a death, and it's a rewiring of your nervous system, of your perceptual circuits and all the rest of it. Spiritual performance becomes embarrassing, so you start to realize that the identity of being a meditator is actually very counterproductive and doesn't really make a lot of sense. I mean, it makes a lot of sense from the standpoint that humans will take a lot, pretty much anything, and make an identity out of it. But from the practical point of view of, well, if I want to progress with my meditation, you realize that making an identity out of it is actually the opposite of what you should be doing. The actual real path is to see through your identity and to realize that there is no one meditating. There is no fixed self. There is no permanent thing that you call you. And therefore, how can you even make an identity out of it? How can you give yourself a name? How can you wear clothes? How can you advertise your meditator identity? Because doing all that is really just a distraction. However, the sense that you are approaching awakening remains. So on one hand, you can say that awakening goes from being this sort of lofty project to being, okay, this is doable now, you know, I'm getting there, right? And ultimately, this is an illusion. But at the mid stage, you still kind of externalize awakening, and you make it into a conceptual. You build it into a conceptual framework and hold it in that way, and it's only when you finally realize that that awakening itself is a concept. And that you are externalizing everything. That is really what brings awakening anyway. There's often a grief at this stage and a loss of your ambition, because you've gone from being the sort of upstart, like an ambitious upstart, with all this energy and sort of motivation to meditate and to broadcast it and all the rest of it, to just realizing to some degree that there is no permanent self, to realizing that spiritual identity is a fiction or it's a distraction, that it's a story, to realizing that your thoughts are just appearances. You know, it's less sexy, but it's also a lot deeper, and it's much more connected to right now and what is actually happening right now, which is just your experiences occurring. Whereas the early stage is still kind of in fantasy land, really. It's spiritual, conceptual fantasy land. Okay, let's talk about the late stage, because we've spoken about early and mid. Let's talk about the late stage. This is very, very rare. I'm going to say less than 2%, but I have to say I've met very few people at the late stage. And I'm reluctant to claim I'm at the late stage. One, because it's rare. Two, because to say that you are is to kind of to try and own it and to try and make it into something. And three, it actually doesn't seem that important to me anymore. I don't really care about awakening anymore in a certain way. So I don't know. I'm certainly not early stage, and a lot of the mid stage stuff seems like I've gone through a lot of that. But I don't want to claim I'm at the late stage. And even you can think what you want. You can come to your own conclusions. They might be projections of yours. Have to take that into account. It actually doesn't matter. Let me talk about the realization. What you realize at the late stage is that there is no awakening to achieve. You cannot achieve it in any way. The whole idea that awakening is this project and this sort of goal and this kind of like destination, you realize that that is a complete illusion. And it was an illusion based on ordinary perception and the idea of a self separate from experience, right? And not realizing that all experience is you and always has been, and everything that you think that is outside yourself is you. Okay? This is where it's deeply paradoxical, because even talking about this requires me to disown my experience. It requires me to take subject and object seriously, which it's possible to realize that subject and object are themselves an illusion. But anyways, you realize there's no one to become awakened, because you realize that the self is, it's not a thing, it's everything, but it's also nothing at the same time. And that may sound very sexy, but it basically means you can't locate a self in experience. Like, there's no permanent thing there that you can call yourself as separate from experience. And of course, when you talk about these things, you inevitably tie yourself in knots, because it's actually very obvious experientially, but trying to put it into words is very challenging. It doesn't mean there's no self per se. It just means that the way you look at what self means is very different. You can still live as a self. You know, I can still do what I need to do, but it's not taken in the way it used to be. It's kind of like seeing through an optical illusion. It's not that the picture changes necessarily, because the actual, you know, if you looked at the individual dots and everything, it's just the perspective on it changes. It's like the way you look at it completely flips around. And this is what awakening is like. There's no self-improvement project, because you realize nothing is outside of you. And that is a shocking thing to realize, but once you re-own all of your experience, you kind of, you question the need to improve yourself, because often improvement is first of all based on the idea of a permanent self, which you realize isn't true. And it's based on separation between self and other. It's based on trying to sort of improve self against the world. But if you realize that there's nothing outside of your experience, and there's nothing outside of your sense of self, well, What is there really to improve? Now, I'm very cautious of saying this because when I reflect on my life, I can see that I'm improving in a lot of ways, and I can see that I need to improve in a lot of ways to improve my happiness and my functioning. And I'm constantly working on myself. It's just your relationship to it. Again, it's like seeing through an optical illusion. You don't have to not do anything to improve yourself. Because of course, being attached to the idea of not improving is also kind of just another attachment. It's just you're not so invested in the idea because you realize that there was nothing ever separate from you, and there never is and there never was. And so there's not that big sort of contrast. There's not that kind of past, future, you know, self in the past versus self in the future, because you realize that the self is just always, the self is ever present and omnidirectional, shall we say. Anyways, what does this late stage look like? Let's go into more details here. Identities function but are worn lightly. So it can be easy to think as a late stage, that late stage meditators are in the mountains somewhere and they don't speak and they don't know anyone and they don't have any friends. But see, this is like an early stage fantasy. This is early stage, the early stage minds of projecting and imagining what it must be like to have insight. And it's quite the opposite, really. I mean, of course, there will be plenty of late stage people that they maybe live in this way, but there's no reason why this has to be the case. And in fact, I would argue that the most embodied awakening happens when there is no, you're not trying to sort of, what's the word, siphon it off and divide it and create this kind of like partition of the awakened self living an awakened life. It's just life as it is, but you've fully reintegrated it and you've fully realized that there is no escape. And this is like, in the marrow of your bones. It's like right down to sort of the core of your moment-to-moment perception. You realize there is really nowhere to go. And so you can wear all these different masks. You know, you can be a partner and you can be a friend and you can be a business owner. And it's not, you don't have to take these things seriously, but you also don't have to reject them, because again, that's not very balanced. The middle way, as the Buddha or Buddhism teaches, is very, it's a good teaching in this particular context. Thoughts and emotions arise without ownership. I just want to clear up this point because it might sound like dissociation. It's actually such a profound re-owning of your thoughts and emotions that you realize there is no need for a self to experience them, that they just arise on their own. You can fully feel them, you can fully let them arise in your consciousness, in your moment-to-moment experience, but there's no need. You see through the labeling process, you see through the process of ownership, and you just let them be as they are, right? So not owning them doesn't mean like you're creating a sub-personality, or you're creating like a, you're trying to like push them out of awareness. It's such a profound owning that you realize that you don't have to resist them whatsoever, because resisting is really the main obstacle. There's no chasing bliss or curating spiritual states. So again, at the early stage and even at the mid stage to some degree, you're chasing a certain experience. You're chasing a moment different from this moment right now, and you're trying to get from here to there, and you're basically saying this state is not good enough, I want to feel blissful. But you see, this is not what happens at the late stage, because again, you just realize that moment to moment experiencing is occurring, and you fully feel it and fully let it all arise. Now, obviously, this is a skill. So these are very broad generalizations I'm making, but on the whole, you are letting experience arise without resisting it. And this is a very deep rewiring of your nervous system and of your perceptual system. Ordinary life is enough, because again, you just realize that there's nowhere to go and nothing to get. Not as a story, not as like a slogan, but it's really just, it becomes very obvious, and you realize that you can see the mechanism of striving, and you can see the mechanism of building castles in the sky and chasing after them, and you no longer have to do that, because you realize that that itself is really one of the main sources of suffering, and it's one of the main things that takes you away from your current experience, your mind, body, sense experience right now. Okay, so let's sum up the three stages in one line. The early stage will say, I am practicing to awaken. The mid stage will say, awakening is happening through this organism. And the late stage says, there is no center for awakening to happen to, because there's no permanent self. The self is just an amalgamation of patterns that come and go all the time. And so there is no sense of a subject, a permanent subject, and therefore there is no, life is not happening to anyone or anything. So those are the three stages of meditation. Churn them over, have a think about them, and use these as a guide to your own practice. You know, if you've been at the early stage for 10 years, for example, maybe just meditating more isn't what you need. Maybe you need to, say, bring it into daily life more. In fact, in my meditation classes, I, from the day one, get people to bring it into daily life. I really challenge them to bring it into daily life, because this is really what brings deep insight and deep change. Maybe the early stage characteristics are no longer serving you. And maybe the mid-stage characteristics, you're starting to realize the limitations of those. And so this can really orient you. And just knowing that there is like a vertical dimension to meditation, there's a sort of developmental trajectory, can just help you slowly initiate that over time. Obviously, this takes years to unfold. But even just knowing about these stages can really help you, and it can help you getting stuck in the early stage when it's not necessary. And that doesn't mean that everyone needs to be a mid or late stage meditator. I mean, the chances are that they probably won't, but maybe you can go beyond the early stage. All right, everyone. Thanks for listening to this talk on the early, middle, and late stage of meditative insight. Please subscribe to my newsletter for fortnightly updates. Subscribe to this podcast and look out for my snippet episodes on Friday, Sunday, and Tuesday. Sorry for that. Sometimes I forget which days they are. Friday, Sunday, Tuesday. And I'll be back next week with a fresh episode on the monthly, the theme for March, which is meditation and spirituality. Take care.